Not every age has a Hermes Trismegistus. There have been many ages of darkness and misunderstanding. And one of the responsibilities of the Hermetic tradition is for a comprehensive teacher to clear up by bringing together all of the strands of truth and of putting them together into a renewable form, not a form in itself, but a place of transformation. The Grail, sometimes the translation of the Greek word is not grail, but sometimes it is basin, sometimes it is cup, sometimes it is chalice. The Greek word is crater. And actually by crater is meant what in classical Greece was called a kylix. And the kylix was a bowl, a drinking bowl, that is not very high. It's about 2 inches high at the most, but maybe about 4 inches in diameter. But it has two handles on it, so that one lifted the kylix, the primordial crater, with the thumbs on top and the two hands, and you drank this way. And when you drank, you had to tilt the horizon of the crater towards you. And the handles on the kylix are made in such a way that if the cup were to be removed and the two handles put together, they would make an infinity sign. So that it was a mystical, initiatory symbol. I don't want to say implement, because an implement connotates a ritual. And this had nothing to do with ritual. This is a much higher level. And we'll talk today about what constitutes a higher level. This Hermetic treatise is called The Crater, in the sense that this treatise is what is shareable, but the handles of this treatise are what constitute infinity. And the two handles of this treatise are the two persons who are speaking. The treatise is a dialogue between two persons, between Hermes and his son Thot, between the Hermetic, how should we say, student is the best term, but our connotation of, you see, our understanding of all these words is so scrambled and confused that we don't hear the wisdom in the language anymore. Initiate would be a closer term, but it has metaphysical connotations that are somewhat at oblique angles to what the ancient understanding was. In effect, the understanding was that Hermes and his son, that the wisdom master was like a father. He was not a teacher to a student, but he was a father of this son, or a father of this daughter, for there were many women who were quite extraordinarily adept. The last great Hermetic teacher in antiquity was Hypatia, and she was extraordinary. And she lived on into about 410, 415 AD in Alexandria. And her prize student was Synesius, who later on became a very famous bishop in the nascent church. So that sometimes a Hermes Trismegistus is a woman and the student is a male. or it's a woman and the student is a female. In either case, the archetype is father and son. Whether they're male or female is not as important as the archetypal relationship of father to son. Well, why is that so? We talked about it last week, but it didn't register in our hearing. It takes a while to accumulate the penetration to be able to hear what is being said. And that's why this is 13 weeks, because it takes that long for this to settle in and occur to us that something very extraordinary is being given. It's called holy wisdom, and it is real. The father and the son, the masculine, is always a generative form, whereas the mother and the daughter are always a nutritive form, and they are complements. They go together. And nutritive rises and generative descends. And their interpenetration creates the horizon, which we know as life. Just as there is a horizon of the earth where heaven meets the netherworld, and where they meet is the surface horizon of the earth. And in a spiritual way, the descending gift of the Spirit, the generative Spirit, comes into contact, into interpenetration with nutritiveness. This has the quality of generating and nutrient so that there becomes an interface. It's just as if I take these two hands. If I bring these two hands together and I do it conscientiously and slowly and energize and bring psychic energy into play, I can feel the heat in between the two palms of the hand. You could too. I'm not too good at psychic energy, but I have seen friends who are very good who can do this and create an electrostatic event. It's the meeting of the descending and the ascending together. It's that meeting that creates what is called in the Hermetic tradition a horizon. And that horizon is like a membrane, and it's permeable. It allows for energies to come through on their way down to be bestowed, and it allows for energies to ascend and penetrate through and achieve. The crater, the grail, the cup, the chalice is the place of the meeting. And so it is this horizon, this meeting quality. Perhaps pass this back. That'll be fine. It's this meeting quality that's so very important in this dialogue. Now, Hermes, when he is speaking to his son Tot, and Tot's name, T-A-T, is a palindrome. It's the same whether you spell it frontwards or backwards. Tot. It's a word like radar. It's the same forwards or backwards. And it's meant to show that this particular student is extremely accurate, has a kind of a balance, has a precision so that Hermes can present in either order, a descending order or an ascending order, and Tot will understand. he will understand whether you start from here and build up, or whether you start from up here and descend down. He can, in this sense, form a complete double interface with the teacher. And because Hermes also has this capacity, the dialogue between Tot and Hermes is not a dialogue just between two, but between an equanimous pair of pairs. We would say ambidextrous. Tot can understand either way. Hermes can teach either way. And so we have in this treatise, it's the fourth treatise in the Corpus Hermeticum. Our translator calls it the basin. I prefer to call it the grail, because that gives the true connotation of what this is all about. What was in the grail that renews life? The blood, but the blood was a metaphor of wine, and wine is a metaphor in itself of fermented water, spirit, spirited water, spirits. So what is in this particular dialogue are the two who, when brought together through the membrane of the conversation, through the membrane of the language, of the shared language, when the two are brought together perfectly, in that the median in between them that initially separates them is a language form specially designed to collapse in upon itself and disappear, allowing for the two that were held apart by the language to progressively become one. It's like something that is ecologically sound and designed to perfection. It is a disposable form that allows for a space to initially occur between two people, and as they progressively use it, make the language real. The language being made real takes all of the substance of the language form, so that without a substance, the language form vaporizes and disappears progressively, allowing for the two that were initially separated by the process of making, lifting the language off the page, as it were, allowing them to come together. And when they do, the perfection, the completion is finished. If one were an outsider, if one were not in the Hermetic tradition, if one were an academic and understood this procedure, you could characterize this as a very ingenious Hellenistic wisdom technique, an initiation technique. And I suppose in that kind of academic milieu, it would be an apt characterization, but it would miss completely the phenomena that is displaced by something that is underneath phenomena. We have to talk for a minute about that. What do we mean? What do I mean? What is meant by saying that there's something underneath phenomena? What is underneath phenomena? It is called noumena, or noumenon, singular, phenomenon, noumenon. And that the two of them together, a phenomenon, always is here not as itself, but as a part of a ratio, the denominator of which is the allness of all things. So that when a hermetic understanding looks at an object, it doesn't just see the object, but it sees the object and its noumenal base as a ratio expressing some characteristic, some quality, some facet of the whole. In this case, when I see this, I do not see a rectangular three-dimensional form that is able to be opened and sliced into small planes. I see a book. The recognition of book tells me the noumenal qualifying context of this phenomenon. This is not a rectangular volume. This is a book. This is the specific book which we're using, the Corpus Hermeticum. So that when the noumenon under face is seen at the same time as the phenomenal object and seen together as a ratioed pair, then meaning is possible. Then meaning is said to be generated by the symbolic energy of vision that is applied to this. I have to learn to see this as a book. I have to learn a lot to see this as the Corpus Hermeticum, and I have to learn a very lot in order to understand what this really means and its significance. So that meaning is generated by this paired ratio, proportionate, symbolic emanation. And what does this? The book doesn't do this. The noumenon itself allows for this to be done. But what is the trigger? What is the active agent that allows for this to be done? It is, in the Hermetic tradition, the mind. The mind. But the mind is a part of the noumenon. It's a part of the all. And mind by itself would be wildly the unity mysteriously behind even the cosmos. It would have no delimited focus wherein one could introduce a phenomenon and have some kind of ratioed proportion established. So that the mind must be in a receptacle, a transformational receptacle. I think the word that was used very aptly in the Renaissance is the word which translates into English as a crucible. In order to have the transformation of thing to a ratio of phenomenon, noumenon, symbolic understanding of what it is, we have to have the mind put into a crater, into a crucible, into the chalice, into the grail. And when the mind is in that context, then the mind can transform. What can it transform? It can transform things out of this world into ratioed, meaningful, symbolic insights into very large meaning. In other words, we make meaning out of things by transforming them, by using the mind in its crater setting. And perhaps you've seen occasionally in esoteric paintings, you will see the skull used as a cup. Like in the Vajrayana, very often a skull will be used as a communion cup. The skull being the crater, the place where the mind is. So that the cranium, the rounded part of the skull, or the skull itself, is this sense that here we have the place, we have the basin, this is what it is. But in the Hermetic tradition, there is a basic emendation which very rarely is understood, and is understood in the 20th century largely by quantum physicists and cosmic astronomers. In this dialogue, Hermes begins by saying to his son that the incorporeal, the non-thing, is not extended in space. It's the very first statement that's made. This statement is astonishing. And it begins in the translation with these words in English. For the incorporeal is not a thing perceptible by touch or sight. It cannot be measured. It is not extended in space. It is like nothing else. What he is saying is that what we are addressing ourselves to is not in any way a thing. It is not a phenomenon. And so Tot is told right away, adjust your sight. Stop looking at things and start symbolically to look with your eyes conditioned by an understanding mind. And when your mind, as an understanding context, uses the sight of the eyes to see this ratioed aspect, then there is a symbolic structure that is activated. The very first symbolic structure that is activated in human beings is ordered sound. Ordered sound, out of which eventually comes language. So that the primordial human symbolic ordering, composing medium is language. And in fact, Tot asks Hermes to clarify for him a statement which has been made just after the statement that the incorporeal is not extended in space. What was that second statement? That all men have speech, but not all men have mind. And Tot says, could you explain this? And Hermes goes on to explain it. But in order for us to understand why all men have speech, but not all human beings have mind, we have to first understand this previous introductory thing that the incorporeal is not extended in space. The simplest way that I know is to just say this. In a Newtonian physics, this thing, this object here, exists in time-space. It exists in the three dimensions of space, and it occurs in the fourth dimension of time. So that its phenomenality is dependent upon its space-time qualities. Now, Newton was never so naive. He was a very good hermetic mathematician. He was never so naive as just to believe such a truncated thing. The first person to really believe such a truncated characterization was René Descartes. And it's René Descartes' geometry in which one finds the establishment of the thing in space-time as some kind of definite object, and that somehow good old rationality bases itself on phenomenal thingness. Whereas the Hermetic tradition always understood that rationality is not based upon things, but upon the symbolic ordering of proportions and ratios which generate meaning. That rationality is characteristic of understanding meaning and not of pigeonholing, reducing things to their phenomenal objectiveness. And that objectiveness is the criterion of idiots for rationality. When someone says to you that you should be more objective, the best thing to do is to walk away. Because they're a long way from understanding anything that would be joyful to you. And they're never going to really be a friend. All this has to do with uncoupling time from space. Because as long as the illusion is that time belongs with space, we can make the phenomenal reduction to objectivity stick as an illusion, as a kind of a good-sounding spiel, as a kind of a Cartesian characterization of rationality. But it's only a spiel. It's like a circus barker selling you a bill of goods. It does not become apparent in mathematics very easily because it's very subtle. It takes a real genius, someone like George Cantor or Bertrand Russell, to understand theory of types or theory of sets, to understand why this is just absurd. But it becomes extremely capable of being critically demolished when that kind of Cartesian reductive objectiveness is translated into human patterns of organization called politics, called society. It's very easy to see the stupidity and the reductive grinding down of meaning, the stuffing of the gorgeous amplification of possibility into objective situations, objective laws, objective things, which then are supposed to determine rationally whether we can or cannot be ourselves. And the person who wholesale accepted René Descartes and his reduced objectivity was John Locke, and in his essay on human understanding laid the foundation for forms of government that have come to haunt the 20th century. And the great criticism of Locke's essay on human understanding was not published until 300 years after it was written. It was written in John Locke's time by Leibniz, because Leibniz was a good enough a mathematician, he could understand that this was not very wise procedure to follow, and Leibniz was the great hermetic teacher of his day. What's important here is that by the 20th century, by the 1920s, Cartesian geometry had been philosophically tossed into the wastebasket by people like Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg and Erwin Schrödinger and Ludwig Wittgenstein. And it's quite a bandit outfit. You talk about the Jesse James gang, these guys will hold up the universe. Because as soon as you uncouple time from space, the reductive objectiveness falls apart and discloses the error, the flaw, the illusion that one was trying to participate in. Why? Because time can exist uncoupled from space very adequately. Because time couples itself with energy. And time energy has a whole different quality. It manifests itself as a discontinuous electromagnetic spectrum, and the discontinuities are just as real as any frequencies that do register objectively. And not only that, one can turn the whole thing inside out and have a complementary magnetoelectric spectrum at about 10 billion times the energy with all the discontinuities in place, and one can have a quantum physics of an enormously gorgeous, fantastic universe that is real in so many dimensions, in so many ways. And it turns out to have three different sets of time, three different sets of space, excuse me, but only one time, which is the basis of superstring theory. Murray Gell-Mann from Caltech. And this is like 21st century physics, understood by a few, but making its way, because with this one can understand symbolically a lot that was hidden. Hidden by what? Hidden by the illusion of phenomenal reductive objectivity. And it's like 20th century physics and astronomy is a play of hermetic dimensions of something that happened 2,000 years ago in Alexandria and happened in terms of these hermetic treatises. Only most readers did not have the pizzazz to be able to understand what they were reading, what was being said, what was happening, largely because there was no Hermes in many generations of human life. It was just simply a loss. If time is coupled with space, then you get things. But if time is uncoupled from space and coupled with energy, instead of things, you get presences. You get energized presences that actually occur, that have duration. So instead of a world of things, the Hermetic tradition sees, understands, symbolically sees the meaningfulness in a ordered series of presences. And that because the order has this rising, this ascending quality, just like the quantum understanding of the electromagnetic spectrum, there are discontinuities that allow for quantum jumps, and there are various levels that occur, and then there are gaps in spaces that also really do not occur, and that these levels have a mathematical proportion to one another, so that it isn't a hodgepodge at all, but is rather a hierarchy. And that in this hierarchy of ascent, the complement of a hierarchy of descent also occurs. And while there are eight levels that ascend, there are likewise then eight levels that descend, so that the whole cycle of the real would be a 16-part whole, punctuated very accurately by intervals whose contribution to the real is that they have nothing whatsoever to offer except their nothingness. And so when the gaps in spaces are really gaps in spaces, and the levels which are energized are really energized levels, one then has a cosmos in which movement occurs only by transformation. Because there's no way to mechanically get from here to there, because nothing really touches. So the only way to get from here to there is through transformation. And so the Hermetic understanding is that movement does not generate space, but that movement characterizes transformation, which is a function of time energy levels. And all of a sudden, one emerges in this kind of language somewhere where most of us would be familiar. Oh, we're talking about energy levels. We're talking about the movement between energy levels is due to transformations, and that if one is able to have a ongoing, continuous transformation, one would be mobile through all of the energy levels of the cosmos. And this is exactly what Hermes Trismegistus says to his son. My son, the whole cosmos is our home. And we do not have to stay stuck on any particular level, especially on an illusory veil, fib, which isn't a level at all. And so the Hermetic tradition always has this beautiful symbol. I'll try and bring a blow-up of a hermetic gemstone where Hermes Trismegistus, as guide to the soul, is reaching down to help somebody out of a pit. And you see the other person half buried from the Manipura chakra down, buried, and from that chakra up, trying to emerge, but being caught in between, so that the horizon of Earth cuts right here at the solar plexus. And because they are cut in two, pulled both ways, one part thinking that it belongs there, the other part thinking, well, it belongs there, and you get stomach aches and anxiety attacks and all kinds of things because right there is where they don't meet. But only their disparateness wars. And that neurotic conflict is like the static coming because the station's not tuned in. And what the Hermetic tradition says, when you tune in, you will hear what's being said because it's always being broadcast. And that you have every capacity to not only hear what's being said, but understand, because this is exactly your nature. You are made from eternity to do this to a T. And the only thing that needs to be done is not to teach you about this, but to bring you to a level where you can recognize what you already know. Because it's deeper than that you already know, it's what you really are. You are a complete spiritual cycle that's already intact from eternity. And you don't need any long lectures, but just a period of accumulated concentration in order to bring it to a focus. And that's what this dialogue is all about, that focus happens most simply, most clearly, most concisely in the mind. If one can adjust, first of all, to the fact that the incorporeal, in the Nag Hammadi treatises, it is referred to as the great invisible spirit. If you look in the Gnostic writings that were unearthed in 1945 and published, James M. Robinson edited the series, the Nag Hammadi treatises, writings. The great invisible spirit. Why is it invisible? Cannot be seen. Why can it not be seen? Because the seeing eye is schooled away from the reductive phenomenal objectiveness. You have schooled yourself not to see things, but to see proportions, to see ratios, to see symbolic wholenesses. And so it cannot be seen because it's like Claude Rains covered with some fantastic chemical that is now invisible. It's not that at all. It's that one is no longer looking with worldly eyes. One is looking with holy eyes. And when the holy eyes look, they see this ratioed paredness everywhere. And what generates out of that is meaningfulness that has a kind of responsive quality of being ordered according to a hierarchy which is eternal. What about those who still look with objective eyes? They can identify themselves very easily because they're addicted to a polarized quality of understanding life in terms of pleasure and pain. Because when you do not have the ratio of the real mediating your understanding of what's going on, then you're subject to the conflicts of the polarizing aspect of life, which is pleasure and pain, and you're worried about the one and you're trying to get the other all the time. In this Hermetic document, in the translation that Scott makes, he translates the words as anger and incontinence. Gentlemen, what it means is the old anger of pain, pleasure, duality situation. Notice here that when our eyes are looking to things as a basis for understanding what's going on, we see in polarized vision. And that the ultimate polarizing values are pleasure and pain. And one is forever trapped in that prison, that imprisonment of polarized addiction, until one can transform out of that and take what were disparate, polarized, exclusion qualities and transformatively bring them together into complementation so that one sees this is not the way at all, here is how it is. And one then begins to see, D.T. Suzuki, the great Zen master, once said, one learns to see the world in wholenesses. Everywhere one looks, one sees the wholenesses that occur. This is the beginning of wisdom. Hermes says to his son, Tot, when this begins to take hold, one has a kinetic feeling tone of rising. I guess one of the popular words is levitating. One has the kinesthetic quality that literally, one is beginning to float in the sense that when you're just walking, it's like you're beginning to scuff clouds with your feet. Or you feel a kind of a lilt in the motion of movement. You feel a kind of, the Buddha called it, the first meditation is characterized by rapture and joy. You begin to feel the light suffusion coming through the kind of characterized depression that was always there, of a sense that somehow there's a kind of a lilt, there's a tone, a musical tone. It's like a pitch pipe tone that if one could just concentrate a little more, one could tune into. And that's why people meditate. That's why people pray. That's why people contemplate. Because they begin to get the sense that there is something there, but it's not a thing. It's like a musical pitch which is sounded throughout the whole universe and which we, once we get the glimmer that it's there, are relentless to find it. As the Buddha said many times, the historical Buddha, one cannot give enlightenment to anyone, but if you give the thought of enlightenment, the bodhicitta, just the thought of enlightenment to someone and they really accept it, enlightenment is inevitable in the sense that they will never give up until they have found it. Because once one knows that this is true, this is real, this is how things are, we are relentless to get it, to find it. And so Hermes says in here, those who ascend begin to understand that you can ascend to a height where one can see the good. And here it's the term which Plato used as the ultimate archetype, the good. That is, that this rising, this ascent, is of such a nature that one intuitively understands that you can get to the height to where one gets to the crown, the splendor, the highest point, the good. And that one then gets the complement to this, the complement to the fact that one can rise through energy levels to completion. The complement is that the conditions before that final step constitute a journey, a transformation journeying. And the word that was used in 2,000 years ago translates into a very good English word which means sojourn. That one is only a sojourner here in life. In the sense that you are not just journeying but you're aware that you're journeying. The sojourner has a self-consciousness that this is what they're about. This is what they're really doing. And this is the beginning of turning the polarities of a phenomenal reductive world into the complementarities of a transformational, complete aspiration. And that's what this Hermetic treatise is all about. But that the place of interchange, is the place where the language of Hermes and the language of Thot meet, where this dialogue meets. Where does it meet? It meets in a crater filled with mind. But whose crater? Whose mind? Not Hermes' mind, not Thot's mind, our mind. In a way, this Hermetic dialogue is like a spiritual mirror that says it is your mind that is performing this function. That this dialogue is only the kylix in between the two parts of an infinity, and both these characters, Hermes and Thot, are two facets of yourself. The inner teacher in you, the inner student in you, and one is giving them this script, a very carefully planned script that will, as you use it and generate meaning, the meaning it goes up and it leaves increasingly nothing in between, and the two aspects of yourself, teacher and student, are able to come together. And when they do, the infinity occurs in your mind, in your skull, in your crater.